Welcome to the IWD Roundtable for CKLN's Transistor Radio International Women's Week programming. My name's Trish Salah, and I'm here with a number of trans activist artists who are going to be chatting for the next 50 minutes or so about a number of issues as we encounter them in the, sorry.
In our everyday lives.
In our everyday lives, yeah.
As they pertain to international women.
Is our lives.
So we should introduce ourselves.
Okay, so my name's Christina Strang. Everyone calls me Tina.
I'm Jake Pine.
And we heard from Trish, and I'm Dana Bates. So
and maybe in addition to giving our names, it would be helpful if we actually talked about where we're coming from in this roundtable, both in terms of identities and in terms of the sort of work we do, the kind of issues we find pressing, why we're here today. And I'll start. I'm a writer, doctoral student, sometimes activist with the Canadian Union of Public Employees. I do some equity work having to do with the situation of trans people in the workplace with my union on the National Pink Triangle Committee, which is our LBTG excuse for an equity movement within our union, which is actually quite effective in some ways in terms of doing union education. IID is TS, transsexual, as well as genderqueer. I'm not the most normatively presenting transsexual I know, although I'm far less confusing than some of my good friends. And in terms of identity, what I mean by transsexual, it's probably worth putting out there. I was male assigned as a child, i.e. Seen to be male based upon my body, was raised as a boy, don't identify as a boy, at some point in my mid-20s decided that it was time to start living my life the way I wanted to, i.e. as a woman, and that's involved pursuing a number of transitions. Bodily transitions, social transitions, legal transitions, in name, maybe that's enough for now. Other folks?
So I'm Jake, and I identify as an F2M, a female to male. I also identify as an F2HM, a female to handyman, and a sissy boy. I work for the Male Trans Program at the 519. I do trans access workshops in the downtown shelters and detox centers. And I also am a sex educator with folks with disabilities.
I'm Christina. Everyone calls me Tina. I identify as a transsexual woman. So I've done all sorts of things, but generally right now I work with women and HIV. My particular interest is doing trans people and HIV work. Trans people and sex work. Yeah, that sounds right. And not sure what else to say. That's pretty much it. I'm sure we'll get into other stuff as we go on.
And as I said earlier, I'm Dana, and mostly, first and foremost, I work on a lot of music, and that comes largely from a trans perspective, but that's also has a lot of other important to me things going on. I'm a student as well. I'm doing a doctoral degree in musicology at York. Aside from that, I guess I'm just working, doing things in the community and trying to be myself. I was male assigned also at birth and grew up in that kind of a social environment and where that had definite certain effects upon my psyche that need to be addressed in a public setting, I believe. And as for how I identify, I guess I would say trans. I never really know where to place myself in terms of more specific identities, whether I would say transsexual or transgender, because I've had a relatively unmedicalized past. And yet, a lot of the transitions that I have gone through have been pretty significant for me socially and in many other ways as well. So there it is. Dana, Jake, Tina, and Trish.
We've covered a little bit of basic trans vocabulary in the course of introducing ourselves, but are there any other terms that we feel need to be out there or issues that are I don't know, sort of elementary issues for TSTG people in our culture at this particular moment that should be on the table before we move forward.
Well, Trish, you mentioned identifying as TS transsexual, and you didn't really talk much about what genderqueer meant to you. I'm wondering if you might want to.
Well, I guess it has something to do with being a dyke, and the extent to which, particularly within the dyke community I live in Toronto, butch femme are sort of organizing identities within the queer women's community. And by butch and femme, I'm referring in a general way to more masculine and more feminine presentation in identity. If you ID as a dyke and you're transsexual and your body in many ways reads as male or as masculine, the way in which you position yourself as a dyke within the community involves all sorts of elaborate nuances having to do with the way in which gender gets read and the way in which you play with that. Genderqueer means fucking with gender on some level. It means opening up the possibilities beyond assuming an easy link between masculinity and maleness and femininity and femaleness, and you can do that in a variety of ways. Yeah.
I'm just curious, does anybody else here identify as genderqueer in any way?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. I think I would say genderqueer is just asking the questions of what is a man, what is a woman. So. Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. I don't know if this is kind of jumping ahead at all, but in a lot of discussions that I've had and that I've listened to, particularly online, a lot of people, a lot of transsexual women specifically, have had a lot of problems with genderqueer people co-opting trans identities and feeling like, oh, now all of a sudden it's cool to be trans, let's identify as trans, and not really undertake a whole lot of transition in many senses. And that has really blurred or obliterated the need of a lot of transsexual women, and that's a really specific and very real thing. And these, a lot of transsexual people are still at the bottom of the social heap now, even within the hierarchy of trans. And I don't know, I just thought that was an important thing to bring up and we might want to talk about.
Well, I think there are a couple of things there. I mean, I think that when genderqueer started getting tossed around as a term, late 80s, early 90s, it was a real intervention to what was seen from a certain vantage as a very traditional notion of transsexuality. I think that people coming out of punk and people coming out of a sort of dissatisfaction with what was seen as a very medicalized understanding of being cross-identified, were trying to mess with that in different ways. I think that a lot of the people who were doing that were in many ways also describable as transsexual or transgender. Now, the way in which that plays in other contexts is hard to say. I mean, I think queer in a lot of ways in the early 90s seemed like a really radical way to think about gender, and that there have been disappointments because, as you say, there are various ways in which queer has ended up being gay and lesbian business as usual, and I think that genderqueer might be said to be performing a similar function vis-a-vis transsexuality at this point, because the kind of cachet it has in certain settings, universities, art scenes, are largely middle-class settings. And that means that people play with those terms with a certain kind of net, social net, protecting them. And folks who are gender variant in other ways, who don't have that net and who aren't playing in those institutional locations, do so with different stakes and do so confronting different types of social realities. So I think there's some of that. I know from what you've said to me on other occasions that there's been issues between TS and TG identified people and genderqueer folk at Camp Trans at Michigan. And I don't know if you want to talk about the history of that at all, or maybe that opens up the broader question of how are we thinking about trans people in women's spaces, because there are a whole set of issues there.
Yeah. I think we are getting into how spaces are organized and who comes to what spaces, depending on how they're defined and stuff like that. Trish mentioned that, yeah, I was at Camp Trans last year, and just to put it out there, what Camp Trans is that for decades now in Michigan, there's been the Michigan Women's Music Festival, which has just generally been a music festival for women. About 10 years ago, a woman whose name I should remember, maybe somebody else does, she was a transsexual woman who was at the festival and was asked to leave. Well, not really asked to leave. She was forced. Yeah, she was thrown out because she was transsexual. And so she set up camp aside, well, just outside the gates, and which isn't necessarily a very safe place, especially for somebody from an extremely vulnerable population. And yeah, I think I do really want to emphasize that trans people are a really vulnerable population. And so she set up camp outside the gates of the Michigan Women's Music Festival, and eventually it just grew from that, where a number of activists at first came to camp with her in the summers, including Ricky Ann Wilkins and Leslie Feinberg. Kate Bornstein might have been there.
Davina Gabrielle.
Yeah. And what Camp Trans has evolved into now is it still exists. It's still a quarter mile down the road across the road from the Michigan Festival. And I was there last year, and there were about 80 or so people. And it sounds like a really valuable event, because this is one real focal point where trans people are excluded from, you know, an event which... It's for women, you know. I hope that I don't need to make too strong a case for why trans women are women. but out of the 80 or so people that were there in the summer, only about 4 or 5 of us were trans women. Most of the people there were non-trans dykes and female-assigned gender queers and some FTMs. And it was a party that really felt as though it privileged that certain... range of identities, generally people who were female assigned. And so, you know, in some ways it feels really frustrating that we've come all this way, supposedly, at, you know, recognizing different types of trans, building bridges, bridging gaps, and yet it still comes down to, in women's spaces a lot of times, if you're female assigned, you get the choice of whether to come in or not, and if you're male assigned, quite often you don't, or if you do get allowed in, then you don't get in on all the reindeer games of, you know, the socializing and the real inclusion. What happens is that a lot of the trans women get avoided, and, you know, if something does happen, then we are expected to initiate something, which I feel falls back on us being male assigned and that person having to do the initiation. And when that happens over a person's lifetime, when trans women are essentially avoided in spaces that are supposed to be for them, that can be really traumatizing. And that has true, true psychological impacts on some very, very vulnerable people. And this doesn't just play out at Camp Trans. This plays out at a lot of trans spaces that I've ever been to. Not all of them. Some of them work pretty differently. But... I guess this is where I'm sort of thinking about how genderqueer gets defined, and who is genderqueer, and who gets left out, and who doesn't even bother coming, because, as I said, there were only 4 or 5 trans women at a protest which is supposed to be on behalf of trans women. So I guess I bring up the discussion of Camp Trans in hopes that it will lead to more discussion about spaces in general, and who is invited into them, and who really truly gets welcomed.
When I used to, back not so long ago, when I was coordinator of the Meal Trans program at the 519, I don't know, I think when I'd started out there, I was a little naive in thinking that, you know, I would make like the hostel, or what they call it, it's a shelter system, but we refer to it as hostels in the city. And making it like an accessible place for trans women who most often were denied access at the time to just about every hostel in the city. And at the same time, men's hostels couldn't guarantee their safety, so in other words, they were left S-O-L. See, I didn't swear. I'd set out, like, you know, starting to do workshops, thinking this sort of open up and, you know, great door of accessibility. Everyone would love me, and that would be sort of, and trans women would just go flooding into the hostel systems, those that needed hostels, obviously, and things would be okay. And I realized it was totally not that simple. And I pretty much got fired at just every sort of question. I became the enemy. Whenever I went to a hostel, people felt I was coming to bring an issue that they didn't want, that I was coming as a cause célèbre that they had to listen to for an hour, and then they would have to consider what I had to say. It was gotten to the point where me and my old boss used to call it hostile services, and we had to sort of rethink how we were going to do it. We wanted to make this, like, you know, this was, you know, an emergency services. This would be for, like, you know, women who were, you know, lower income street actives and not have a place to stay in the night. And I'm sure we can all appreciate it's been a really friggin' cold winter here. Mm-hmm. And can you imagine just, like, not even being able to, like, access the hostel system at all? You know, the men's or women's, you know, you can imagine, like, how, like, frustrating, dangerous that is. So, we decided to, like, just take a step back, take a look on, like, how we would sort of look at accessibility and basically relate it to their training. The people who are there, what their training is like, and basically assuming that they're already well trained, they just need to understand more of the trans issues, that we're not the enemy, that we're not, you know, like, for example, in the case of trans women, like men trying to be women, but just like women that are just trying to live and try to stay, like, safe and try to stay in a space, and that just because they're trans people, they're not the cause of every incident mm-hmm. that happens at a hostel. So I had that project for about a year, and it's taken off and it's gotten much bigger, and actually Jake took it over. So we want to talk about where it's at these days. What are you seeing now?
One of the things we're seeing now is changes in the intake procedure in shelters and hostels, where they're saying, like, on intake when someone comes in, you know, we have lots of different women here, we have women of color, we have women of different religions, women with mental health issues, and we have trans women, and this is what a trans woman is, and this is why she may not look like a woman to you, this is why she's using this service, do you want to stay here? So people are getting the option, you know. Another issue that has come up recently is there's sort of more and more FDMs coming out, is where do FDMs stay in the shelter system? So men's services aren't safe if you haven't had chest surgery, and if you're not on hormones, if you don't pass, you're going to be staying in dorms with men, and showering with men. Not safe. And then women's services aren't appropriate because you identify as a man, and sort of this where do you go stuff, you know. So we're working with women's shelters now around the issue of would you house an FDM occasionally, and not that you're going to be overrun with these baseball hat wearing zitty boys, but that you'll get the occasional one. Identity aside, it's safety issues, you know. So I think it brings up lots of interesting issues around gender, because it forces people to look at the hierarchy among men, so that man is not a homogenous category, and there are men that are unsafe in men's spaces, and FDMs are one of those people.
I think it's worth raising the question of you know, the difference between how someone identifies and how someone lives, because in a certain way I think that the issue you're just raising about the safety of FDMs in some ways has to do with where that person is at in their transition, if they are transitioning, because it also has to do with whether people pass as women or men, and safety will be more of a factor depending upon where you are on that continuum of passing one way or the other. It is complicated because, of course, you know, the ways in which someone who is FDM will pass after a certain period of time on hormones may not transfer vis-a-vis male to female. MTF people, hormones don't have the same effects on trans women's bodies, and, well, not the same, but don't have comparable effects, as it were, in terms of the degree of passing. But at the same time, people make a choice to live in a certain way, and I think that choice to live as the person you feel yourself to be will have long-term effects on how you are read in the world and on the kind of social safety you experience And so, as you say, with FTMs, it's a fairly short-term period, I think, where there's going to be, well, short-term period, assuming people can transition at the speed they want to transition. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Whereas MTEFs, there's the question of long-term visibility as transsexuals to being part of the package in some cases. So I think that needs to be thought about in terms of how services are tweaked, as it were. The other thing I wanted to come back to a little bit is, you know, Dana, you were largely addressing Michigan, and Michigan's a social space in a lot of ways, but I think it's worth thinking about the way in which Michigan acts as a sort of touchstone within women's community as to what is acceptable in terms of the ethos of women's communities across North America. People go to Michigan, they have an amazing experience or a horrible experience or an ambivalent experience, and they come back and say, this is what things were like at Michigan this year. And in some ways that translates into what people bring back to their communities, how those communities get shaped. So I do think that there's a tie-in between what may seem like a fairly specific situation, a women's music festival that happens during the summer, and the situations of service providing for trans people around North America and the cultural spaces we make around North America.
Mm-hmm. I think the common issue is safety, because it's what comes up and it's what gets used as an excuse for a lot of things. Is what has been used as an excuse at Michigan Women's Festival is that there are women there who are survivors of violence or survivors of rape or assault, and that they're going to be triggered by the presence of a trans person, whether MTF or FDM. It seems they'll be triggered by either. Although the penis is the big issue for a lot of people.
Penis, it's always ruining everyone's fun.
Yeah. and I think I use the word excuse very deliberately because it does get used as an excuse, which is not to say that women's concerns aren't real, because they are, right? But I think it brings up the issue of what does safety mean? Like, and I think we need to lay that out on the table straight away, is that women's spaces, like biological women-only spaces, are not necessarily safe. So
there's been an interesting analogy that's been discussed in different places that I've heard, where, you know, if there's an incident of, you know, triggering or violence, or, you know, let's say between a white woman and a person of color, you know, well, generally, well, when one person is perpetuating an oppression on another person, if somebody is attacking somebody else, do you blame the victim or do you blame the perpetrator generally? And, you know, you've got to make sure that the spaces are safe for the most vulnerable populations, is the way I would see it. So, you know, that means that trans women need to be safe there. If somebody is having difficulty with us, is that our fault necessarily? No, of course it isn't.
I think the biggest problem was a lot of the service providers, particularly the hostels, didn't really understand about trans people, and their training just went out the window. I mean, they would totally like respond in a situation if it was racially motivated, something that they'd had like, you know, tangible training on. When it came to trans issues, they just reacted. They were just like, you're messing things up, trans person, you're gonna have to go. And that would be that. I'll give you a good example that I swear to God, this is almost like the urban legend of the hostel system, where, okay, here's the setup, you know, somebody, and it's not funny, it's just, it's really like, you know, kind of, you know, funny in a real sad, like, not good way, but a transsexual woman shows her penis, okay, to a resident at the hostel. It triggers, a past incident of sexual abuse, and they, you know, go to one of the staff. The staff are like, you know, what should we do? You know, this person is having a very real experience. It's coming out about their past abuse, and we have this person that they perceive as a man, whether or not that's the case. Obviously to make it a safer place for the person who has the sexual abuse, maybe we should ask the trans person to go. But the problem in that situation is two people lose. You know, they've just, you know, put out somebody who didn't actually do anything that may have, you know, triggered an incident of past, you know, sexual abuse just by being themselves, you know. And for starters, no one really, like, goes around showing their penis anyways, but just by being themselves has, you know, brought up this incident. And then you have a person who has brought to a staff a member of a past sexual abuse, and they're not... The proper way to deal with it would be to, like, sit down and talk with this person about what exactly is happening with them. maybe take a moment to explain about the trans people, but I mean, this person's coming with a very real issue, and just by, like, you know, putting the trans person out the door and hoping that everything will go away, two people lose big time.
Yeah, it doesn't make a distinction between causing someone's trauma and triggering someone's trauma, because what survivors often say is that anything could be a trigger, so like a sound or a smell or a color or a type of music, right, and those things can't be banned, nor can trans people be banned from shelters, so triggers can be managed.
And just for the record, I remember, because many, when we first started doing the hostel project, in its very beginnings, we had to do a little focus groups and tests and ask around all our participants that were accessing the street active services at the 519 I was working with. And I asked them, you know, just off the top of the cuff at the end of my focus group, like, in all likelihood, don't take it wrong, what would be the chance of them seeing your penis? What is the chance of you showing your penis around? And I never got anyone that said, like, you know, they would purposely show their penis. It was always like, you know, like maybe a fraction of an accident that may have happened, like once or twice. But, you know, it seems it's not sort of one thing that goes around. And yet it seemed like a lot of service providers I had were living in deep fear, you know, of these naked transsexual women wandering around. And, you know, I think I guess there's a higher big stigma happening around of trans women in the system. But
can I just jump in on something that you're talking about, Tina, and that is wording and language? Because everybody, I think particularly trans people, have different ways of seeing their bodies, and, you know, they might be different than the way other people might see them. Who knows, really? But what's most important is for you to be able to identify your body on your own terms and have agency over that, and for people to respect that. And while it may be true that some trans women and some trans men may identify themselves as having a penis or having breasts or having, you know, whatever other words they want to use, because there's a whole lot of words that people use, and some are really great. Not everybody
can't be broadcast on the air.
Yeah, let's broadcast all of them. That'll be next hour. The thing is that, you know, I don't want people to think that all trans women necessarily have a penis, even if, you know, they might not have had surgical treatment or anything, because I certainly wouldn't use that word for myself, and I respect people who do use that for themselves.
I guess I'm just you're absolutely right. I'm one of these people that just get very implicit. I just throw it out, and it's like, it's a penis, and, you know, you're right, and, you know, and I wouldn't even call necessarily the fact that, you know, I have what people would see as a penis, as much as I call it my, actually, it's kind of cute, I call it my chick stick, but,
it's a good one.
But, yes, my favorite, it's cute. That's the next hour, yeah. I think the reason I said it is because a lot of people have this conception that, you know, why don't we just take the transsexual women who have had sex reassignment surgery, and those people can stay in the women's hostels, and the ones that haven't can go to the men's hostels.
Well, see, the whole thing is creating divisions amongst women.
Yeah.
And there's been a whole history within feminism of creating divisions amongst women, because at first, you know, a lot of women's organizing happened, I think, based on an imagined shared biology or shared life experience, and the emphasis on a shared biology was kind of understandable, I think, because that was the basis upon which a lot of women were attacked. You know, oh, you're not suitable to rear children if you do such and such activity or whatever. And so a lot of organizing happened that way. And then, you know, then that, of course, excluded trans women because, what, we seem to have different biologies, which I would dispute. And then, of course, prior to that, there was a lot of racism within feminism as well, and so the whole imaginary homogenous group really had to be changed. And so we talked about gender-based oppression, and that's something that all women face in different degrees and in different ways, and it's something that trans men face as well. And that's why I think it is really important for women's organizations to not be woman-hating, and ironically, many women's organizations do hate other women, which is something that I have troubles getting my head around, but maybe I shouldn't. So when services are provided, I believe that they need to be provided for trans men, trans women, and non-trans women, you know, if they really want to be based on gender-based oppression. It's interesting that judging by the suspicion with which trans women are treated, I would assume that, or I would infer that, a lot of women see us as having some upper hand or something like that, where we are a threat. And that's totally a power dynamic that I find incomprehensible, because, as I've said before, I really believe that we are a very vulnerable population, and Tina has talked really well about the emergencies that a lot of trans women exist in, and that's their our day-to-day lives a lot of the time. And so I think it's obviously really transphobic then for trans women to be seen as having the privilege.
Yeah, there seems to be an assumption that trans women, like, formerly, before transitioning to female, lived as, like, powerful male CEOs or something, and then they transitioned to female. And that could happen sometimes, but, like, the reality is a lot of trans women weren't experiencing male privilege when they were living as male. They were experiencing harassment and violence because they didn't pass as male first, before they didn't pass as female.
That said, and I think that that is true, I think it's worth thinking about the fact that people do transition from different places, and the kind of issues that people contend with are necessarily different. The issues facing someone who is involved in sex work are, for instance, is going to involve a risk of violence that is much greater than many other professions for those who are actually working. The people who are transitioning from a low-income place are going to be dealing with questions of how to deal with welfare and social services much more quickly than people who have, for some period of time, worked professionally, acquired a certain amount of education. At the same time, I think it's really important to recognize the way in which people's transitioning radically undercuts undercuts the social status they may have acquired in their lives. I know that I was doing very well as a graduate student until I started to transition in the early 90s, and the kind of break that created in my life had me dropping out of grad school, losing employment, those sorts of things. So I had a certain amount of cultural capital, and I've in some ways managed to recoup some of that, because we're at a cultural moment where there is a certain hipness around trans people in certain circumstances. It was possible for me to apply to a PhD program as someone who put transsexual on the form, but it was possible to apply to one of perhaps three or four universities in the country that it might have been possible to apply to. So, you know, in some ways people's stories are very particular. People's locations vary a lot and are undercut by or bolstered by different elements in their lives. And I've dealt with a lot of harassment, but I haven't dealt with a physical assault wherein I was actually frightened. I've dealt with assaults which I felt like I could handle in certain spaces, and that's had to do with the spaces I've been in. So I think that those things are worth tracking, even if, you know, there's nothing absolute about this, you know?
Yeah, and, you know, there are trans people. Trish is a remarkably accomplished person, and, you know, I think I'm really lucky that I have a job and that I go to school and that I'm able to get out of bed in the morning, because, you know, the fact that we're able to accomplish things outside in the world doesn't necessarily mean that things are a lot easier on the inside, because people from all sorts of populations have been able to achieve different types of rights and access and material success without necessarily improving their psychological well-being. And that's, I think, where a lot of us are lacking, not to try to put things on other people, but this is a really important point, I think, that it's easy for us and it's easy for allies to be active around eliminating barriers so that, yeah, maybe we can get into a university, yeah, maybe we can get into a women's center, maybe we can get into whatever. We can get our doctor's access, you know, if we fight for that. We could possibly get legal recognition if we fought for that. But those sorts of systemic things still don't really break down the power dynamic that exists on a personal one-on-one level between non-trans and trans people. And that's something that I think not enough people really have questioned within their own lives. What are the unconscious interactions that you have with trans people? What are the ways that you would treat a trans woman differently than you would treat a non-trans woman? Because these things are hard to maybe recognize. They're the things that we take most for granted. And yet, because of that, they're the most insidious things. And I think that they can, for me, you know, I recognize a really true psychological impact that I really do struggle with. And so there are very real mental health care needs that are kind of across the board, I believe, for a lot of trans people. Being male assigned is part of that, and not identifying with that assignment, where, you know, people still impose a binary gender system based on your birth assignment. And I don't know, it just prohibits a lot of real integration and a lot of feelings of self-esteem and so on. So although some of us cope better than others, it doesn't necessarily mean that we're less affected intrinsically and in terms of our self-worth.
Yeah, I want to go back to your use of the word systemic a few minutes ago, because I think that it's worth pulling that apart a bit. I agree that there are psychological impacts to confronting those power imbalances you were talking about on a day-to-day way, in a day-to-day way, and I think that it's worth thinking about the way in which the consciousness of trans people is colonized in various ways, and what decolonizing trans consciousness might look like, because I think that the fact that our body image and our psychological self-understanding comes from interacting with non-trans people for the majority of our lives is significant. I think that there are real analogies with the way in which racism is internalized and homophobia is internalized. So those are important. But I also think that in terms of gaining access to a women's center, gaining access to a shelter, those tend to be local changes that are made with the help of allies in specific situations. And I think if we're going to talk about systemic oppression or broad-based social transformation, we have to recognize that if we're talking about the exceptions that are affected by small groups of trans people in specific contexts, there hasn't been a systemic transformation. You haven't changed the way in which people are likely to be confronted with oppression if they step outside of the locale that they, with the people around them, have made safe in a certain way. And to talk about that, you'd have to talk about things like decriminalization in the case of prostitution. You need to think about ways in which violence is socially regulated in a really broad-based way. Need to think about the way in which legal status of sex is administered, and, you know, getting your own name changed doesn't change the fact that everybody out there in the world who hasn't been part of your personal name change process may be confused by your identification being consistent with your appearance. That, you know, there may be a whole, because the symbolic values haven't changed and the broader practice hasn't changed, you may have managed with some people in a specific community to have made a livable space, which is an important thing to do and what we do. But I think that I just want to touch on the ways in which larger changes are necessary in a more broad-based way.
Mm-hmm. In a really concrete way?
Concrete ways, but also in ways that do affect, you know, people's expectations within the culture in a broad way. Yeah. Would you guys like to comment?
You brought up, you know, the topic of like decriminalization of sex work, and you know, that's one thing I truly feel would probably liberate the trans community. Seriously, it would liberate a lot of people at the same time. But yeah, it's just something that's sort of fresh on my mind. Especially as of lately. I mean, with that whole thing with Robert Picton out in Vancouver, and Vancouver and people in British Columbia are getting ready to, like, you know, take it, make a federal change, you know, and have decriminalization of sex work happen. And it's going to be a long and drawn out process that hopefully we'll see us end. But I think very few people realize, like, we know what that means. A lot of people think that, oh, it's just easy enough if, like, you know, we provide, you know, a lot of services, you know, if we, you know, had more, you know, it's just like things in the system in place for people so that they could access the services and the need, and then they wouldn't feel the need to go out and sell their bodies and make money for that. But a lot of people, that I think that sort of goes to a really big misunderstanding of sex work. In relation to trans women specifically, I'm not going to lie. A lot of people say it would be a stereotype for me to say that sex work is really big in the trans women's community. I say screw them. Sex work is really big in the trans women's communities. But I don't see it as one of those things that's sort of dragging us down. I see that as like a founding piece in this community. I see sex workers were really like, you know, the glue that held this community together for a long time. They were visible, they were out there, they were very brave in times when a lot of people didn't even know a lot about trans people, and a lot more dangerous times than now. And it seems like lately, like, you know, they've been getting stabbed in the back, you know, or they've been used as examples to further a more conservative and more, you know, conforming community, and I think that's crap. Seriously, like, I mean, there are a lot of reasons why trans, like, you know, women might end up getting into sex work, but really, we're not going to get into today, because that could be a part of an even bigger sex work discussion, which you all heard on Monday. It was really great talk, and if you can't go to the website at
www.ckln.fm.
Yeah, and you can listen to it, but, I really feel that, you know, one of the things that would truly, 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 truly help out this community is if, like, a lot of people, not just trans people, although I would hope you're already there, but a lot of people would really start, you know, questioning, you know, are the laws of sex work right now really, you know, valid? Are they oppressing women? Are they really, you know, laws that are just more morally charged than anything else? And the answer is, like, yes. So I don't know. I just, it's been something that's really been on my mind. And, you know, there's a province now that's making a push for it. I really feel that it's one of the things that could truly, like,
Tina, can I interrupt? Sure. Are you talking about Libby Davis's private members bill to review the sex work laws when you said...
There's two right now. There's one yes and there's one no. There's one that's basically counteracting the first one. One's to review the law, which is not, like, to push to decrim it. The other one is basically just sort of nixing that and looking more at putting money into women's programming, women's housing, women's community-based services. And I wish I remember their names, and I wish I remember the name of the bills.
Okay.
What's outside of Ontario is sometimes very difficult, but...
Yeah, you said decrim it. So could you just say what you mean by decriminalization so that people have a sense of that?
I think a lot of people get sort of confused about the difference between decriminalization and legalization. What we're talking about is making it so that basically the federal laws would not recognize, like, communication for the purposes of sex work, you know, as something that would be sort of against the law. Because sex work, having sex for money, is not, you know, illegal in this country, but the laws surrounding communication for it that are... which make it a lot more difficult to work with safety, to work with dignity, to work, you know, basically,
right.
Yeah, within...
And likewise, the body house laws and the
yeah.
pimping laws, they surround sex workers' lives with a set of laws which allow police to harass them in various ways.
Yeah. But, you know, a lot of this... When people think about the sort of, you know, street active, you know, thrown out there in the cold kind of transsexual woman who's, you know, selling her body so she can raise enough money for her sex change operation and is just, you know, being forced to use her body to get to that sort of situation, you know, they're caught up in a different stigma, not realizing that the reason that sex workers find themselves in sometimes, you know, dangerous and vulnerable situations is not because, you know, they're selling sex for money. It's because of the laws surrounding it that force, you know, sex workers to work in some often very dangerous conditions and often in situations that don't allow them to even seek out, you know, protection of, you know, police or their neighbors and people around them. And if this changed, then, you know, people will be able to, like, you know, work from their homes, work safely, unionize,
mm-hmm.
you know, not put up with, like, bad work conditions if they're working for, you know, a manager or as you said earlier, a pimp, although hopefully if there come laws, like, people that would be exploiting, you know, people for their money, that would sort of change, you know, a lot of things would change, you know.
Well,
I think it's just people's attitudes around how could people possibly, you know, even consider this sort of thing.
At the a sex work conference I was at in Montreal a couple of weeks ago, I heard a local activist, Mira Soleil Ross, talking about violence against sex workers. And one of the things she said vis-a-vis the pimping laws, which I think, you know, is worth reiterating, is that the pimping laws are usually applied against family members, yeah, friends, people, cohabitants, children, under some circumstances, of sex workers, not people who are forcing people to have sex. And forcing someone to have sex is illegal. It's rape or a form of sexual assault. Forcing somebody to work against their will is illegal. So the pimping laws involve, in some ways, creating a special net to grab the people who have relationships with sex workers, and penalize
your landlord, even actually,
for
living off the avails of.
So there's that side of things. I mean, vis-a-vis exploitation, all labor is exploited. If you work at McDonald's, if you work at a university, your labor is alienated. This is, you know, you don't see the benefits of your wages in the same way that the person you work for does. So, you know, that rhetoric, I think, is worth taking apart a little bit. The other thing I wanted to get to, you mentioned the stereotype of the transsexual woman working for her surgery. And certainly sex work is lucrative, and people do have financial difficulties in getting surgery, hormones, any number of things. There are different ways in which that can be taken.
But the trans community itself perpetuates that sometimes,
oh, for
which
sure.
is so even more
There's
than disgusting.
There's a lot of bad attitudes towards sex work in the trans community.
Yeah.
Like, in a lot of ways, the trans access work that sex workers do goes unrecognized, you know, that they're out there every day changing people's attitudes towards trans people, sleeping with influential people.
Yeah. Sorry. For sure. But I wonder, you know, just trying to make a link between this discussion and some of the points Dana was raising around power imbalances and what it is to be in a body that is male assigned, there are also questions about the psychological impact of being in a body that one feels alienated from, and the way in which that is economically regulated by a lack of access to surgery and hormones and procedures. So the way in which trans people, one way or another, either need to contend with a certain remapping of our bodies in terms of being psychologically well in a way that goes against established and assigned meanings as to what a body is and what it means, or need to get the dollars together one way or another to physically intervene in our bodies and transform them. And I think, you know, there are both psychological and social and economic consequences to that. Some people, middle class people, you know, their first big investment might be a car or a house. Other trans folks who are involved in physical transition are always weighing any expenditure of money against, okay, what does it take to actually bring my body into a place that I'm okay with? That's both a burden and I think a factor in thinking about where a sense of exclusion comes from as well, because while I think that there is a huge amount of systemic or social hostility towards trans people and sort of freezing of trans people in certain contexts, there's also the prolonged experience of not being all right in your skin. And when people talk about the mental health of trans people, I think, you know, there's an urge to say mental illness is a stigma, want to get rid of the stigma, but there are mental health issues that have to do with dealing with the difficulty of being wrong-bodied in various ways.
Yeah. It'd be nice if people could start perpetuating the myth of the strong, you know, happy transsexual hooker who's out there, like, defending the world and, as Jake said, like, you know, using their, you know, body for political and, you know, means to change things, you know, because that's how, you know, I definitely, like, that's how I know some, like, you know, girls, and that's definitely how I'd like to think of all of them, you know, that they're, you know, they're smart cookies, you know, they're people who've, you know, using their experiences in their bodies, you know, to their own profit, to their own ends, and I don't know, it's worth throwing in there.
Well,
totally, like, you know, a sisterhood among themselves.
Well, absolutely. I mean, I think that a lot of what has prevented people from having positive images of trans folk, including our images of ourselves, is, you know, these thousands of years of colonization, basically, which have placed trans people in historically an abnormally low social position, because it hasn't been that way for, you know, all of history. There have been many, many instances of trans people just doing not only fantastic things on their own, but occupying a place in society, which is, you know, extremely, extremely special. And, you know, for some reason these days, a lot of people are getting a lot of crap thrown at them. And, you know, that comes in the form of shaming, which is a tool of patriarchy, basically, and colonization. And it's almost a religion of, you know, shaming people based on a lot of physical attributes, you know, where it's hard to be comfortable in your body then. And so I think that also historically there's just also been a lot of interesting interactions between FTM and MTF, where, you know, basically people who do not lead lives within a binary gender system have had really special and important places. And I personally take a lot of comfort in knowing that, you know, that the way things are right now is not the way things have, the way they've always been. And, you know, I look forward to creating and participating in a time when things can be different, and, you know, just trying to feel differently about myself and other trans people, because, you know, politics based in your feelings of self are, you know, some of the strongest changes that are possible, I believe.
Maybe in some of our last minutes now, we could talk a little bit about practical things about trans people in women's spaces, like practical tips for people who are thinking of making their place accessible, whatever it is, if it's a women's center, if it's an organization, whatever. I don't know, does everybody want to answer that a little bit?
Yeah, that sounds like a good idea.
Okay.
For my part, just in terms of the type of work I do, again, it mainly has to do with workers' rights. So unions can make getting, well, basically language that recognizes people's self-identification into their bylaws and into their collective agreements, which recognizes people's right to self-expression in terms of dress and in terms of uniform, so that the way in which people's presentation works isn't regulated in a negative way. Respecting people's identifications means opening women's caucuses within unions to trans-identified women. At the same time, recognizing that acceptance goes a bit further than that, and support goes a bit further than that, making things like benefits, full benefits, a bargaining priority, so that, at least in Canada, if you've got full benefits, you've got funding for people's transitions, and that if that's actually something that a union prioritizes, that allows people to live their bodies in a certain way, and that in turn feeds into people being able to suivant.
I wanted to say, like, in the disability community, access means access with dignity, so it doesn't mean getting in the door. It means getting in the door and then how you're treated once you get there. And I think things that are important to remember about access is to be proactive and not reactive, so not to wait for someone to come crying or screaming that they've been discriminated against, but to be proactive in making places accessible before that happens. And I had another one that I've forgotten. Oh, that access is a partnership that's done between trans people and women if it's a women's spaces, if it's a women's space that we're talking about. So having an investment in rewriting your own policies and not waiting for trans people to do that work for you, but to do that work together, I guess.
I would say, you know, the one thing I've come at in having spent almost my entire adult life in this community is that I think that trans people, you know, are the most beautiful people I've ever seen, and I think that says something.
Are you talking about yourself again?
No, I'm talking about all of you. You should see these three; they're gorgeous and they're awesome. And yeah, and me too. But you know, it goes without saying that not, and this doesn't just apply to trans people. The self-esteem is the number one motivating factor for any high-risk behavior you can think of. You know, if you really want to make yourself accessible, you know. Think about, you know, the self-esteem of a trans person when working with them, and that, you know, when you start to, you know, single them out because they're trans, that, you know, that's only the beginning of, like, you know, a bigger problem. I mean, we're people, you know, that, I'll be honest, like, you know, a lot of, like, you know, how people saw me, you know, had a lot to do about how I thought about myself. And while that may not necessarily be right, it's not necessarily wrong, and not just trans people think that. So, you know, think about self-esteem, not just for trans people, for everyone at your service.
Yeah, for the most vulnerable people particularly.
Yeah.
I don't nearly do the amazing political work that Trish does or the amazing social work that Tina and Jake do. But when it comes to defining spaces, absolutely thinking about access and thinking about who is there and who is not there, and just really working to help people feel comfortable and welcome and wanted. Feeling wanted is a big part of things. Are things is a space structured as women and trans, or is it structured as trans and women? Who has priority? I think that's an important question to look at, and hopefully in dialogue with trans people. If trans people are welcoming your space, then at what stage, at what point in our transition are we allowed in? Is it only after we become recognizable to you as trans, or when exactly do trans people gain access? That's a really difficult question, and I don't have answers to that. But these are more things to be thinking about, I think.
Right. So just with regards to union work again, I'm a representative of the National Pink Triangle, who deals with trans issues in the context of union work. If you go to the QP website and go to Pride issues, you can actually get our Tranny 101, our Transsexual Transgender 101 fact sheet and contact information for the committee, which is doing education in the union movement more broadly around trans issues. And that's just www.qp.ca. And then go to the Pride page.
Oh, yeah. And the fabulous program that Tina used to coordinate that I work at now is the Meal Trans program at the 519. So Monday nights, it's a drop-in. It's from 6 to 10 for anyone on the trans spectrum, trans or questioning, and their allies, if invited by a trans person, for a meal and a chit-chat.
Where?
At the 519 Church Street. Phone number. 416-392-6878, extension 104.
Or go to their website at www.the519.org. Some stuff I remember from my old job. Not much. And thank you for putting up with me and my DayQuil-filled head. But I now work for an organization called Voices of Positive Women. HIV is something that, you know, is really big in the trans community as well. You know, they say that, you know, lower-income and street-active, you know, trans women specifically have one of the highest, you know, HIV rates of any marginalized community that does not receive any kind of specific programming or outreach pretty much outside of the 519. And we're holding a fundraiser, actually, called Love to Dance. It's a dance-a-thon. It's going to be at the Mockingbird on March 22nd. I had to look that up. If you want more information, go to our website at www.vopw.org, or you can give me a call. My name's Christina at 416-324-8703, extension 25.
And it's always such a pleasure to talk with Tina. If you're not doing much before the 22nd, on the 21st at Buddy's, Mira Soleil, who Trish mentioned, and I will be playing some songs, so feel free to come out to Buddies. And if you're online and looking for some really amazing discussions and very honest talks, there's always strapon.org, which is strap-on.org, and there's a message board there, which is really actually filled with the most active and honest discussions around trans that I've seen anywhere. So it's a place where I certainly do a lot of thinking, and a lot of others do as well.
Thanks very much, and thanks to CKLN for having us. Have a great IWD.
Woohoo!